Hello, hello, and welcome to another episode of the Red Couch Theology Podcast. Hey, this week we are talking about some of the challenges that we find in leadership in church. Why is it that Christians are oftentimes the number one right reason why people don't want to be Christians? What's up with that? It's painful. Maybe you've been hurt by the church. We're going to talk about some of those tensions and how we're not the best at evaluating what good leadership even looks like, and how does this affect how we show up as Christians ourselves? So without any further ado, let's dive into all of these very convoluted questions right now. Hello, everybody.
We're talking to you.
We're live.
Oops.
Wait, what was that? What did you say?
Well, you said someone shouldn't use this space without talking to us. And I said, more importantly, without talking to you.
Yeah.
I'm pretty useless on these things. So.
Oh, yeah.
Use the space. It's fine.
And I didn't even listen to your statement. I just went live.
You just went live because here we are live.
Hi, everyone.
With our huge...
It is 11 o'clock our time, which you're probably not watching. No one really watches live. Well, that's not true.
I watched live and I tried to interact live and there was no answer because you and Sean were both so busy when
we don't. So if you're commenting live, we never see it because I don't actually pay attention to the live stream itself.
Well, next week I will not be here. You might be live.
Yeah, we'll have to figure that out.
Unless we try and do a cross the Atlantic.
What time would that be for you?
For me, that would be 5 o'clock in the afternoon. No, 6 o'clock.
You need a break. As much as it'd be kind of fun to have you in from from Europe, from the homeland.
Yep.
I guess we'll let you take a break.
Well, you guys will just have to, you'll have to find someone to jump in and, you know, you'll find someone. You got a lot of friends, a lot of contacts.
Yeah. How's it going, man? I feel like I was out sick the beginning part of this year, week. So I feel like we just need to catch up.
Yeah. How are you? What's
in a weird
on?
Sense.
Yeah.
But maybe the podcast is the best place for that. Can you guys just like not pay attention for a minute while I just catch up with my friend over here?
Well, I'm good. But how, I mean, more importantly, how are you? You're not sick anymore?
I actually feel great.
Oh, wow. Those are great moments when you're like,
weirdly good. So like yesterday... Normally, Wednesday night, my wife volunteers in student ministry here, and two of my daughters are in student ministry, so they leave, and like, I can't stay awake until they get back. I'm like, I don't know what it is, like Wednesdays are just long or something, I don't know,
so but
I'm
usually like, bed and you just
I put
crash.
The baby to bed, and I'm just like, trying to stay awake till my other girls come
I
home.
Love it.
Last night, I was just like, they came home, I said goodnight to all of them, and then I stayed up and like got some stuff done and did some reading, and like then I went to bed. I was just wired and I was like tons of energy. And then this morning I got up and I was like, I shouldn't go to the gym because I'm still sick.
But you did.
I feel great. I went for a run.
A run. I don't really understand people that run. So there we go.
That's I didn't understand why I did it either.
It's kind of like my pickleball feelings as well. Like, you know, I don't get it. Like, it'd be like good for you. You seem to like it, but. So if there's any runners out there,
running.
I don't understand. No, apparently people do. Some people.
They're lying. You know,
they force the world into order by footstep after footstep after footstep.
Yeah.
So it is what it is.
Anyway, how about you?
So I'm pretty good, but not as good as you, it seems.
I don't know. So I feel like I got some energy.
I know those moments. I said that to Laura the other day. I was like, I just feel amazing.
Yeah.
And not like, you know, like I'm doing anything amazing. Just like I feel
just physically doing good.
I just feel great.
Well, I've been so low energy this year that was like a weird experience where I was like, oh, this feels like my old days where I could actually like have some energy. Maybe it's just the fact that the sun is out longer.
Maybe that's what it is. The flowers are out, the birds are out, the bees are out, I guess. The birds and the bees are out, being birds and bees, or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah.
Oh,
okay.
Where are we going with that?
On that strange note,
speaking of
you
doubt,
tuned into this theology podcast to hear how our personal physical well-being is.
Ramble. I am going to England this Sunday evening, so that's I'm excited about that.
I bet you are.
I mean, it's
been a while.
It has. I'll miss my wife and kids a lot when I'm there. That's a bit of a sadness. You know, it's so exciting when we all go together. But I'm looking for some good conversations with. Looking forward to some good conversations with parents, siblings, like people
That's awesome.
From that side of the world.
I'm so glad you're going to be able to do that. Actually, I noticed last week that your voice was a little quieter than mine.
And my voice is always a little quieter than
Shocking.
Yours.
Yeah. But I'm actually going to turn up your gain a little
bit.
You
have one of those, overpowering voices.
Yeah. While I turn up your gain a little
bit. I'm going to start talking like you. I've been showing my kids the Avengers movies. We've been going through the Marvel movies, my two oldest kids, and this famous scene where like Thor, who has this deep commanding voice, meets Chris Pratt's character, Quill. And he obviously has a much lower register and he starts trying to mimic Thor's voice because it's so he's like, no, this is how I talk all the time.
That's amazing. Oh, man. Well, I mean, I don't know if it's too early to dive into what happened Sunday, but...
No, it is not too early.
You brought the heat, man.
Well,
I didn't get a chance to tell you, but I was like, I thought you did an incredibly good job on Sunday.
Oh, thank you.
And this is just my personal take on things, and maybe everyone else was like, didn't, but I was like, it was hard.
And maybe
you didn't feel that, but I was petrified of your sermon.
Yeah.
I'm so glad you gave it and I didn't.
No,
and so I was like, okay, if I were in his shoes, how would I have navigated this? I would have had to go here and I would have to cover this and I would have to basically like tell everyone that the church is a hot mess while also not destroying people's faith in the church. And I was like, that feels really hard.
Yeah.
And then I watched you kind of navigate through that process and I was like, well, the Spirit of God and Alex's gifting, that's how you navigate it. Well done.
I felt like it was one of those, where we often talk about not just sermons, you and I, but how a service flows together, fits together completely. And so on a preaching level, it was one of those weeks that feels like I've got 50 minutes of content here and it's 20 to 11. And I could just blow through the end of the time, like the service time. But like to do that and just let loose feels like it's not going to just go over. It's going to massively go over.
Yeah.
Like we're going to be sat here, like trying to conclude with a song at 11:35 or something like that.
Yeah.
So I think then you're kind of like mentally trying to figure out, is the stuff I can cut? Where would the emphasis be if I can pick certain things? Like what would I not want people to miss? And so for me, what I tried to do in that situation was I tried to just really almost like rush through like some of the quotes, rush through some of the like the ways I might navigate people through who's this person, why are they important, all those different things, even just some contextual background to like who's writing this passage of scripture. And so it feels like those seams that I guess you might call them just kind of like they get a bit raggedy. So just on a preaching level, I always dislike that. I'm like, it feels rushed. I feel rushed. I don't like that experience.
Yeah, it didn't feel rushed from my perspective.
Yeah. So it can just be internal pressure. It doesn't.
We knew the service was going to be tight.
Yeah.
Not that you guys listen to this podcast to figure out all our internal anxiety about services, but we knew the service was going to be tight, and then I took even more time.
And
then the child dedications and all that stuff. So that's just how sometimes it goes. But I felt like it was the right. So what I sensed was, and maybe again, I would love your comments on YouTube or send them in to the podcast or whatever if you felt differently. But for those who have felt hurt by Christians or by the church, or who have seen others hurt by the Christians in the church, they felt seen. I know I felt seen in those moments where I felt those kind of things.
Well, that's the fun part.
They felt seen.
Like, yeah.
And acknowledged, and then our eyes were turned to Jesus. Like if that's all you can do with one of those kind of subject matters, then that's probably the best one you can do.
And I think it probably is. You know, so that was the good conversations I had afterwards with people, you know, with one young guy, and he's like probably in his 20s, early 30s, that hadn't been to church for years, that happened to come for the dedications, who was like, oh my goodness, I just feel so safe here. Like I'm definitely coming back for more of that. So those conversations are always fun. Like some people in our community that you know, just was surprising people that I wouldn't necessarily have associated with that, that said, you know, thank you for talking about that. This is some of my story. Like, this is what the last years looked like, or this was something that happened 30 years ago that just was really, really just emotionally challenging. I think that the part that I felt like I sacrificed was really the last part of, like, what if you've just, you feel like you dealt with the intellectual aspect of this years ago, like churches are full of people. Jesus said that the church would be full of wheat and tares. It would be full of wolves in sheep's clothing, all those different things. Like, intellectually, this is going to happen. Yeah. And it hasn't hit me personally. But if anything, your tension is, how do I not contribute to the church looking awful? Yeah. Like that was kind of my third category of people that I had in mind.
That you, and you felt like you weren't able to cover that.
Well, I felt like that was the part that it just skipped over, because I really think we have a bit of a crisis point with the church in terms of, you talked about this over Easter, our understanding of the crucifixion is pretty weak. And you know, that usually to me feels like almost like a pendulum. Like, are we crucifixion people, or are we resurrection people? And depending on the church, depending on the cultural moment, sometimes one or the other. And yeah. actually lots of, like, churches historically, quite a few of them had crosses with the circle.
Yeah.
Because it was the cross and the empty tomb.
Yeah.
And so trying to be both seems to be important, but I had felt challenged over the last couple of weeks by a few things I'd heard and read around take up your cross and follow me. So, like, that was quite a personal insight to me. There were moments, ways I was reacting to stuff. And I was like, the problem with this reaction is you're very much alive in this situation.
Hmm.
Like, you're responding out of, like, either personal preference or responding out of irritation that something has impinged on your space, time, whatever.
Yeah.
And that actually, like, maybe that is a weakness in where you are in this discipleship process right now.
Yeah.
So to me, when I look at America as a whole, like, I just think we've got a lot of Christians that are just very alive in the worst way. They're very alive to their personal preferences, very alive to an unsurrendered, like, there's a lot of unsurrendered lives, I think. There's a lot of like, and then, so I tried to pull that story of Peter with Jesus into the interaction with Paul. So yeah, he has this interaction with Paul where Paul really calls him out on some of, you know, his actions and how they're maybe spiritually abusive. And then tried to marry it to the moment with Jesus and Peter where Jesus says, "Get behind me." Accuser is simply the term, but we would probably have the capitalized Satan. Again, Satan is not a noun in Greek writing. It's a verb. So, you know, it's like, get behind me, accuser. Get behind me out of your accusative posture or something like that. But the behind aspect is very important. You're not leading, Peter. You're trying to lead, but you're not supposed to lead. Get behind me into the following position of a disciple. And anyone who wants to come after me must take up their cross. Now, of course, like, and you did a great job talking about this over Easter, or leading us through this over Easter. You and Jessica worked on this. Like, you had this sense of, I want to talk more about the cross on Good Friday. I think you've been reading Fleming Rutledge on crucifixion.
Yeah, I'm still reading it.
And Jessica did this amazing job walking through some of that narrative as it reflected on Peter as well.
Yeah.
This gospel account in Matthew 16 that I read is all before that. But still highlights the taking up of a cross that is not polite conversation in a first century world. I actually read someone, I heard someone say recently, another pastor say, talking about the cross in the first century is probably the best example of it is how we might talk about sexual abuse in the 21st century.
Huh.
Like, we'll make reference to it and we'll acknowledge it, but we would never describe the moment. Like, it's too raw and too broken. You wouldn't go into huge details about, like, what happened or the mechanisms or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's why when you actually read the four gospel accounts, the passion of Christ, the movie, is all imagination and it's all historical research, but you don't get it from the gospel accounts. Yeah. Because it is just something that wouldn't be talked about. It's just, and they crucified him.
Yeah. And everyone already kind of knew, right?
Yeah. And knew not to talk about it.
Yeah.
Like you don't, you know, the cross was a horror. So when Jesus says, take up your cross, I'm sure the reaction from the disciples is like, wait, what? I didn't come here for that.
Yeah.
And I think there's probably some element to which us as followers of Jesus in the 21st century, I think we're probably a little bit like, I didn't come here for that.
Yeah. So, there's a quote you read, or it was, might've been your rephrasing of something. I don't know if you can pull up your slides.
Probably. Should be able to.
But it was something about how we are drawn to leaders.
Oh yeah, that was a quote. That was a Michael Jensen quote, I think.
And I feel like, why did that feel to me like a palpable moment to be said on a platform at a church?
Yeah. Yeah.
It doesn't mean that we are not at risk, even at South, of ever going to that place.
Definitely not.
But it is to say something like that out loud from a platform at a church feels so important to me.
Yeah, we've definitely...
And now everyone's like, what did they say? What did they say?
I'm going to find it here in a second.
Because it feels so true. And it actually makes sense that power and all these things tends to win the day. That's very human. Like, you know, survival of the fittest and the powerful win and the smartest win and all this stuff.
Oh, yeah, Michael Jensen.
So, let's hear this.
We frequently promote narcissists and psychopaths. Time and time again, we forgive them their arrogance. We bracket out their abuses of their power because we feel that we need that power to get things done.
Yeah.
And I think that's, yes, that all organizations do that to a degree.
Yeah.
I worked for a municipal, like governmental organization as a greenkeeper on a golf course. And we used to joke that if you were over 6'2", you were definitely going to be a manager. And if you were over 6', you were probably going to be a manager. Like
I would have been a manager.
They would have loved you. You would have been running the whole thing. So they intrinsically looked for people that represented a power dynamic. And so organizations do that. Organizations, you know, they are attracted to people that will steamroll other people to get the organization, but also themselves where they need to go.
Yeah.
And yet, so Jesus knows this about us. It was true of Israel. Like Saul is chosen.
You mentioned that. Yeah.
He was like, that's literally what it says. But
that guy's tall. He should be the leader.
Yeah. God tells them, don't appoint a king. The king will mistreat you. He'll steal your, you know, sheep or whatever. He'll
tax the heck out of you. Yeah.
Yeah. Don't do it. And they're like, no, we really want a king. And then they look around and they're like, Saul's really tall. Like that, just what a stupid way to pick a ruler. And then you think about like, great rulers, like and I'm a little bit biased, but I would say Queen Elizabeth has truly been one of the great monarchs in world history, like across the whole of it. And you know, she's this diminutive, like
even if the standard is just do no harm,
like absolutely, yeah,
very little harm,
yeah. But like you think about the period in history she had to navigate, you moving from like the 50s post war all the way through to 2020. probably the biggest curve in history in ever. You know, in the 50s, computers are almost non-existent.
Yeah.
In the 60s and 70s, they're the size of like a two-story house or whatever. And, you know, there's like the shift is just incalculable in terms of the reach of a voice on media, all those different things. So like, but would never fit the picture of what a great monarch looks like if you base it on the Second Samuel model of Paul. Sorry,
little lady.
Yeah. Yeah, little old lady in the end, at least. So I think we've done that historically, and Jesus sees it about people when he is on earth. He actually specifically says to his disciples in the midst of their argument about who gets to be in charge. He says, the rulers of the Gentiles argue about those things. They demand power. It's not going to be this way with you. And it's like for,
and here we are.
It's like for certainly the last 200 years of church history, and even more so for the last 60 or 70 years, it's like we thought he was joking. It's like we thought, like, yeah. Can't really mean that, because, you know, because powerful people get stuff done.
So full confession, maybe one of the reasons why the message resonated with me is because I feel a massive tension with who I am as a person and as a leader and this way of Jesus. Or fear, trepidation. Because here's the reality. I am tall.
You are tall.
I have a huge voice.
You do have a large voice.
And I have personality traits that are very commanding.
Yeah.
All of those things, and it used to feel like sweet. God's given me these giftings, then obviously I should start like using these gifts to lead. And then the more I get to know the way of Jesus, the more incompatible that gift set feels with the kingdom.
Yes.
And so I feel like there's this invitation of Jesus saying, yes, I gave you those gifts, lay them all down. The way forward is to let go of your size, your voice, your personality to take command. And if you want to lead in my kingdom, great.
Yeah.
But it's not going to be using that set of tools. And so I constantly find myself like, am I exerting this as a surrendered gift, or am I exerting this as me taking control of the world, not Jesus taking control of the world? So
I think that's
when
so
you
wise.
Say this thing, I just sense red flags all over my own life and my own personality and my own gift sets to not be that kind of leader and to fear it and all of those things. And so like you say it on the stage and I was like, yes, I want to be the surrendered leader like Jesus and all these sorts of things. And and I just appreciate that.
And there's some, you know.
It's convicting.
And I think it's supposed to be convicting to all of us that lead anything. Peter could easily have looked somewhat like you in his day. And yet he still becomes a leader in the church.
Yeah.
Like I think some of the question is like, how do you not just say, well, if you have any obvious trait that looks like a leadership trait now discluded. And I think there is like a swinging of that pendulum that can be, you know, right now, I think you were to say, if you were a white male pastor or preacher and you wanted to be a conference speaker, your moment has probably gone. And maybe rightly so, like almost every conference is heavily trending towards like, we've got to show diversity on stage. We want to promote people with different backgrounds. We want to make sure that there's a good mix of male and female speakers, like to the point that like, you know, your opportunity is again, like, and now I'm not saying that as a complaining thing, like white males have dominated the stage of conferences for decades.
Yeah.
So perhaps that swinging of the pendulum is a necessary thing.
Yeah.
But I think some arguments I've seen that say literally, if you're a white male, don't lead anything. Maybe going too far.
Totally.
So I think that's one aspect. And then we also, I think, have a problem in that if you don't fit that, I'm going to try and say this carefully, I think. if you don't fit that model of someone who looks like they could lead something, again, in the world's understanding of what a leader looks like, it takes a lot of resiliency and intentional focus on the power of the spirit within you to stand up and lead without being intimidated by the people that, again, I'm quoting, quote, look like leaders in the world's view.
Yeah.
So I think that, like, that's a hard thing to do. The pastor I first worked for, he became a follower of Jesus at this revival chapel in Birmingham in England, like heavily industrialized town, going through a lot of poverty at the time. And this was called Hockley Revival. Like, and it was run by these two little old ladies, Miss Fisher and Miss Reeve. I think I've maybe mentioned them before. Like, if they were 5'1", they were wearing heels, like tiny little people, but so captivated by the power of God within them that, I mean, Dave, this pastor I worked for, is 6'+" and about 280 pounds. He used to work on doors of bars before he became a pastor. Like, he was a bouncer. He, you know, he used to beat people up for a living.
That's awesome.
And yet they would walk up and down like with these eyes like of just fire, like looking at people and be like, okay, like, you know, who needs to get born again tonight? Who needs to get filled with the Spirit? And just like so captured by the power of God within them that they were unintimidated by people that looked like leaders.
Yeah,
so like there's that challenge on all fronts, right? How do you, as a person that might look like a leader, not lead in the world's traditions? And how, if you're someone that doesn't look like that, how do you recognize that actually, like, you have to take Jesus seriously when he says that's not important?
Yeah.
Like, you have to engage with the power of the Spirit within you and say, in a worldly level, this person, 6'4", 250 pounds, may look intimidating.
Yeah.
But the power of God in me is greater than the power of the world in that person.
Yeah.
So I think there's things for all of us to do.
See if I can find this Fleming Rutledge quote, but keep going.
And so she was, and Fleming Rutledge was one of those people that led decisively as someone that may not have looked like a leader in the world's terms.
Have you ever seen her?
And yet she was crazy.
Have you ever watched
smart.
One of her sermons?
Yeah, I don't think I have. I don't think I've ever watched
her. So
I've heard her, but I don't think I've ever watched.
Yeah, I don't know. I was expecting like this, like, older woman who's like really stately.
Yeah. Would know.
She's just like a Southern Belle.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
She talks, she's kind of casual.
Yeah.
And I don't know why. She was like so disarming and so casual because she writes at such a high intellectual level that I expected her to be more serious. Uh-huh. And she was a little bit more like jolly than I expected.
Yeah, and I wonder whether there's not some people that, again, not having watched her preach, I've heard some of her sermons, but there's some people, like I used to occasionally go and I heard Rob Bell out in Michigan when we lived there. And I'd also read his books, or a couple of them. And when I heard him speak, I was like, oh my goodness, you are such a better speaker than you are a writer. Like, just the way that he communicates in person is just spectacular. And I wonder if some, like Fleming Rutledge, it's not the other way around.
Yeah.
You know, like, the writing is such a high level. I almost wonder how you replicate that on a speaking level. Laura and I went to hear Phyllis Tickle preach. I don't know if you ever read any of her stuff, but she was like, I mean, at the time she was like her mid-80s, still living. She lived on a farm and she'd just come off the farm to like come preach at a conference or something like that. And she could say things that other people couldn't say based on her experience and her background. She just lit up the room. And I think everybody, this was a high bar of speech. Like, there were some great speakers there. And it was, you know, compelling all week. But she spoke last. And I think every single one of us went away saying, oh my goodness, that was transformative.
Wow.
So I think, we've all got our stuff to do in terms of healthy church leadership. And perhaps some of that is for people that look in the world's view like leaders to be able to come alongside people that don't, but have that gift and acknowledge it to say, I see the Spirit of God in you and I see this compelling leadership trait that.
So what's wild about the quote you read is it is anchored to getting some stuff done.
Oh,
they
yes.
do get.
Yes.
Worldly yeah, yeah. leaders aren't chosen because they don't get stuff done.
Yes.
They do get some stuff done as far as what the world hopes for or expects. They might build some stuff. They might create organizations. They yes. might build a large entity. Mm-hmm. They might amass a lot of money. Mm-hmm. They might have yeah. a successful business. You fill in the blank.
Yeah. Well, Steve Jobs would be a good example.
Like, yeah.
Steve Jobs ran Apple as he wanted to run Apple. It led it to bankruptcy once. It led it out of bankruptcy because of his incredible gifting.
Yeah.
But there were people that said if he was in a bad mood and he got into the elevator, you just got out, even if it wasn't your floor. Like, you could just get fired for being in the elevator at the wrong time. He was just looking for someone to take his anger out on in that moment. They used to call it getting Steved.
Yeah.
And so you see, like, all the ways which leadership, a great leadership gift is almost an excuse for anything. I actually read that other quote, which was Michael Kruger.
Yeah.
About a pastor in that setting. And it says, in his mind, he is so significant to the work of the kingdom, so important, so valuable that he feels justified in doing nearly anything to keep that ministry on track. If people get run over, then that's because they got in the way of the great kingdom work he's doing. Collateral damage, so to speak. In a sick, twisted way, he is crushing people for the glory of God. So that, yes, yeah. that has been... like the excuse for anything, like part of the narrative around Rabbi Zacharias
yeah.
going to visit all of these like massage parlors, like essentially brothels posing as massage parlors was, well, I'm just so stressed out. Like without a way to relax, I can't function in this incredibly important ministry that I'm a part of or
yeah.
actually the center of.
Yeah. And so the question is like, what does kingdom accomplishment look like then?
Mm.
What is success in the kingdom?
Well, do you not think that's the hard, like, so I think on multiple levels, so I think starting with individual discipleship, there's active discipleship and passive discipleship. There's okay. the work that we do to be transformed, like the work, the things that we enter into that lead to transformation.
Okay.
We get involved in groups. We study scripture. We do all of those different things. We actively yeah. take a time of prayer and they're very transformative.
Yeah.
And then there's also a passive transformation that God just transforms you over time in ways that you don't understand through relationships that you happen to be in through, you know, you and I have both talked about marriage as a transformative agent.
Yeah.
That hasn't happened because we actively did something, but we allowed it to. We were passive.
Yeah.
There's multiple, and there's people that have argued that the second half of life is more dominated by passive discipleship than active discipleship. There's a famous Catholic priest, and I'm trying to remember his name. That I think John Mark Comer quote, and this Catholic priest is asked, "Do you never wrestle with the devil anymore?" And the Catholic priest says, "I used to, but now he's old and I have grown old with him. Now I wrestle with God." And the younger priest looks at him and says, "And you hope to win?" And the Catholic priest looks at him and says, "No, I hope to lose." Like there's this like surrender
wow.
into older life that just is like, you know, now I'm wrestling with my own desire to be all these different things. I'm not wrestling with perhaps with vices as much anymore or temptations, but really just my own stubbornness and trying to surrender it. And so my wrestling with God, is with the goal of losing myself. So that passive discipleship, it seems like it dominates the second half of life a little bit more. Than maybe the active discipleship, even those things are still important. So I think those are important questions individually. And then I think we at times don't recognize the fact that there's elements to that in church as well. There's the things that we think we control and the things that we think we have to action to make things happen. And then there's just God's invisible movement in his bride that happens often without us, entirely out of grace, that we in the things that we didn't plan well, see God move wonderfully.
Yeah.
And in the things that we did plan really well, say, well, that was okay. That was a pretty good thing. And so I think sometimes learning surrender as a pastor and saying, God, I'm going to trust you to move in the lives of people, and recognize, like, there's almost something that beautiful that comes out of that recognition that all of this doesn't, like, I don't form the whirlwind. Like, I don't, like, make it happen. There is no power that I have that can bring transformation to a people, a larger community, a city. But the power of God, if I can get out of the way, is deeply transformative.
So I was just telling my leadership team for worship ministry that, like, I feel like the first 7 years of my time here at South, I worked harder than I'd ever imagined ever working.
Yeah.
I mean, I worked my tail off and I dreamt and and we saw some beautiful things and there were some great stories along the way. But the irony is, like, now I catch myself even during busy seasons and I'm like, am I working? Because there's more of a sentiment. There is more of a sentiment of surrender.
Mm.
And I still do a bunch of stuff, but I don't carry the weight quite the same like I used to. And ironically, I've heard as many transformation stories, as many kingdom stories as the first 7 years. And I feel like I'm doing almost nothing.
Yes.
As far as emotionally concerned. And like, some of I used to wake up in the middle of the night freaking out about, what if I miss this lighting
cue?
Now I'm like, you know, I'm not sure how that's going to turn out or this thing's going to work. And I do move around quickly and I get anxious about some things here and there. But overall, the amount of effort emotionally and psychologically that I put into my role here is like this. I promise I'm not trying to slack off, but I feel like I'm slacking off because I'm not stressed out.
I would vouch for Aaron working pretty hard.
My stress level was what I turned to tell myself that I was doing a good
that's
job.
So wise. Yeah, that's so true. Yeah.
Now my stress is pretty low. So every once in a while, like, I'll go weeks and then I'll be like, am I still working?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because and then the output is actually maybe higher.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm like, how does that work?
And I think some of that's like a gift. Some of that's a you thing, right? It's a gifting. It's a like I think you get reps on, I would say when I was a youth pastor, I got very stressed about how many people turned up to a certain thing.
Yeah.
And then I realized actually some of my metrics were super arbitrary. They were in my head for a reason. Like I remember like looking at it one day and saying like, why is it that if this many people turn up for a high school thing, I'm happy. And this people turn up like a middle school thing, I'm not happy. And like where did that come from?
Huh.
And then I recognized like my stress over what it looked like got very quickly lost. Like, post event in the rear view mirror of life. Like I couldn't remember very much in retrospect, like the things that went perfectly and the things that didn't. Like it just like for the most part, like a lighting cue is a good example of like actually trying to remember a time a lighting cue didn't work well actually becomes quite hard. You're like, can I actually track any actual effects of that? Like looking for the butterfly wings.
Yeah.
I'm like, it's really hard to find one.
Yeah. Well, a great example is, okay, Easter this year, we had a 70 voice choir.
Yeah.
In one sense, it was one of the biggest productions that I've ever put on.
Yeah.
As far as sheer humanity, definitely as far as number of people involved. Yeah. And the lead up, the registrations, the talking with leaders, the coordinating with the choir team. It's not the kind of stuff that I do here at South. A lot of churches do that all the time.
Yeah.
There's also a lot of churches that have worship leaders who really like spend a lot of their time on music.
Yes. Yeah.
Unlike this one. So huge production. The following Sunday, we had no power.
Yes. Yeah.
And in the past, I would have been like, oh no, we're going to lose the momentum of this high energy weekend experience. And Pete, we can't fit everyone here. What if there's that person who didn't know Jesus that came Easter and they come back and they come in and like, there's a me and a guitar from 70 voice choir to me and a guitar. In the past, I would have lost my mind about anxiety about how could this possibly be the right way of doing this? God, what are you up to? This time I was like, meh.
Yeah.
This was beautiful.
Yeah, yeah.
And God is so powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Some acoustic worship in the lobby with the power out was awesome.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't know why I got to that subject, but it's like this trusting for his his process rather than ours.
Yeah, and that I think is I think our bar for success is one, it's pretty worldly. Like, it's certainly out of step with Jesus' bar of success.
Yes.
So
talk about that. What's our bar versus Jesus' bar?
Well, his bar is almost embarrassing. Like, one of the best things I got told as a youth pastor when I was in my, like, probably 20s, maybe even early 30s was someone said to me, you know, if you do this for 3 years, and after 3 years, you only have 12 students that turn up and they never understand your illustrations and one of them wants to kill you. Like, you're where Jesus was after his 3 years of ministry.
Oh,
you know,
there's
like the 12 disciples that he spent all of his time with. They're not in great places after 3 years. So like, his bar is clearly not, like, he's constantly trying to get away from crowds. And we're constantly trying to attract them. And he spends the whole second half hiding from them. So that in itself is weird.
I just did this miraculous thing. Don't tell anybody.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
He chooses to be born at a time where really you're like a rich person could travel at the speed of a camel. And a poor person could travel at the speed of a footstep, which based on most cultures is about 3 miles an hour.
Yeah, he should have shown up with a private jet and hit five cities a week.
Or another couple of hundred years from now when we figured out, like, you know, supersonic travel again or something like that, and just like constantly been moving, which is the stress point of so many pastors. Like, we got to reach people. And none of that seems very evident in his way of being. So there's like visual metrics that we pick out. When I was in the Pentecostal church, it felt like if a service didn't run over, God hadn't really moved. Like, that was a metric that we actually
used. That explains our service. No.
Yeah, yeah.
No,
sure. Which is hilarious because, yeah, you come from a background where you would say if it did run over, that means that, like, well, God didn't move through your leadership at least.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I think we were very arbitrary in those things. And a lot of the time can be tracked back to, if someone was observing whose opinions I really cared about, what would they think about me? Like, what would their value on me be? You know, we had a guy drop in this Sunday who used to pastor a huge church because some of his family come here now.
Yeah.
And we talked in the past about just, you know, things that, you know, like, just I've asked him odd questions in the couple of times we've got to hang out, and would love to ask him some more because I want South to be a healthy community. But actually the most joyful thing he said to me was, as he left, he motioned to the foyer and he said, "You have a really good feel here."
Huh.
And I'm like, oh, man. And more than him saying something like, "That was a well-articulated sermon.
Wonderful sermon. Yeah, great illustrations."
Yeah, 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 yeah. Although the flow of the service was just impeccable or something. Like, this feels like a community. Like, that's just a wonderful thing.
Well, yeah, and I think a gift. I mean, I know who you're talking about. And one of the gifts that someone who's been walking with Jesus for a long time that knows sort of the way of Jesus a little bit and stuff, when they can call out the Jesus way things in another community, it's a beautiful kindness not to point out to some of the expected things that they could point out, and just to call out
Yeah. So I just think that is cool. Valuable. And we have Kevin is a good friend here that, just seeing from someone like him, what holds its value when you hit those retirement years? Like, the thing that he talks about is not there were 2,000 people in the service at one point or whatever. He talks about how he remembers the young guy that got baptized on Easter and came out of the water and yelled hallelujah at the top of his voice and then ran all the way around the auditorium.
Yeah.
Like those surprising out of nowhere, not planned transformation moments. Those are the things that he's still talking about. And so you see that, like, I think if you're younger and you can tap into the wisdom of people that get to a point where, they've maybe recognized what they can offer. Did I tell last week that example of Eugene Peterson, like with the young pastors who, I can't remember, but I think I certainly told you that these young pastors are like, thank you for keeping the church at 300. And he's like, I didn't try. It wasn't humility. It just was the best I could do. But actually now we see some beauty in it.
In hindsight, sure. Yeah, that's good.
You see it in Paul's language when he mends fences with people in his last years that he's fallen out with.
Yeah.
Because he suddenly realized there's a bigger thing than, So I think hopefully we get a bit wiser. And I think if you're younger and you can learn from those people, that's good. But I think also accept we're all going to get stuff wrong. We like every generation gets something wrong. You don't always know what it is. I was mentored by guys that worked 16 hours a day. If anything, my temptation might be to work too little, same as you're saying, in comparison to these guys that, because I watched them destroy all their families.
Yeah.
So if I have a choice between doing some extra work on Thursday at 5 o'clock or going home to be with my family, I'm usually like, okay, I'm out the door. Like, I'll figure it out later.
Yeah. All right. So this might be Pandora's box because we do have a question to get to.
Yeah. And we got 15
so
minutes.
I'm very, this is risky.
Yeah, okay.
Tightrope walk. Yeah, can we accomplish this and the question? But how does this topic of abuse of power within the church, is there a relationship to how we engage in the political arena? Because I think we select our political leaders for similar reasons. Mm-hmm. And is there a difference? Should we have, so I think it's easier for us to make a mental leap. Yeah, we don't want a pastor who's like a megalomaniac and who's abusing a bunch of people and, sexually abusing people or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like we've seen all these failures.
Yeah.
We know intuitively that within the church that that's not cool.
And I think the question you have to answer to get there might be, do you believe in the myth of a Christian nation? Like for some people, I think they would say concretely, I believe America was founded as a Christian nation.
Yeah.
And that it still should be.
Yeah.
And I think I would probably have some I'd certainly have some ambiguity at least over that and wonder whether they just used the language that they had at the time that was most familiar to them, I guess is a term. What I think you can concretely say is at no point does Paul ever come close to saying something like, I'm really praying through who God's man for the Roman Empire might be. Like, who's God calling to lead it right now?
Yeah.
He didn't have any assumption that the Roman Empire would become this thing of virtue that would lead people towards Jesus. And it would have seen a huge discrepancy between the kingdom of Rome and the kingdom of God.
Yes.
So,
okay.
So I think if you think this is a Christian nation, then you actually are more obliged to pray through who represents Christ-like values the most and vote for them.
Okay.
I think if you don't think it's a Christian nation, then I think that to me almost becomes a harder question for me to answer because my expectation is that any government is at best going to be passive about leading people towards Jesus.
Yeah.
So I'm like, you know, I'm almost a little bit more like, God, you got to control this because I don't know how to. I don't even know how to make a recommendation in this current election cycle, almost maybe more than others. Like I'm almost like, oh my goodness. Like,
yeah, but I'm saying like, know. As far as like, yeah. In our political engagement, how do we as followers of Jesus choose leaders in general? Should we aspire to choose leaders that look and behave as much like Jesus as possible?
Mm-hmm.
Or should we try and find leaders that get stuff done, like the quote said?
Yeah, and then to throw in a third element, do you vote for parties that you feel reflect best the way of Jesus? And then the question becomes, which ones and which ones are most important?
Yeah.
I don't know if I have a good answer. Do you have a good answer? Because I don't know.
I don't know. All I know is that, like, I do think that there is a tendency
mm-hmm.
in the Christian American evangelical world
mm-hmm.
to vote based upon whichever one we think will get the most done
yeah.
policy wise, regardless of their moral mm-hmm. life.
Yes. I think that's probably true.
And so, like, which policies are most advantageous to evangelical Christianity in America?
Yeah.
To our plans mm-hmm. and let's vote for those leaders who might get something done in
yes.
that category. Now, again, there's actually massive debate on which policies are most advantageous to Christianity.
I think that's the challenge, right? And which ones are most advantageous to human beings. And so, you know, I've talked to some people at church who would say, I would absolutely never vote for Donald Trump. Like, he does not in the slightest way reflect the way of Jesus. I've also talked to some other people that would say, I absolutely believe that the Republican platform is more in the way of Jesus, usually based on abortion primarily.
Yeah.
I will absolutely not vote for anyone that doesn't have that stance.
Yeah.
And even when we vote in ways that, like, if someone said they voted for Obama in 2008, 2012, a lot of the route you would get down to is, well, I voted for him was because he was a very charismatic speaker.
Yeah.
Like, he was compelling on that level. Like, is that any less
exactly.
just a picture of how we pick people that's maybe a little bit obscure?
So I guess the reason I brought up the question was not because I feel like there's an easy answer. Actually, I think maybe the reason I brought it up was that as followers of Jesus, the fear and trepidation that we should enter into when we choose our leaders should be much higher. We should be very skeptical that we're good at evaluating our own leaders.
Yeah.
Because usually the Jesus way tends to elevate the youngest, which mm-hmm. in that day and age was mm-hmm. the worst,
mm-hmm.
the down, the out, the confused, the weird Peter who never seems to get it right.
Yes.
The Paul of all people, the most mm-hmm. hater of mm-hmm. Christianity.
Yeah.
Let's make him the boss of everything.
And yeah.
So the Jesus way tends to identify leaders. The best leaders to advance the kingdom are the unexpected. So the prayer and the doubt of our own ability to efficiently evaluate good leadership should be.
I think I think this is what I'm going to hypothesize on the podcast because it's a safe place to hypothesize,
okay.
unlike
right,
the
cool,
stage.
Cool.
Right? Okay, so I think I would be comfortable saying that at times we've talked about voting as a spiritual practice.
Yeah.
And I don't think it is.
Yeah.
I think it's a civic privilege.
Yeah.
Which is not the same thing. So there's been a whole history of people, the Benedictine monks primarily were the first ones to really voice this, but others as well, that have said, at least there's a possibility that my spiritual position makes it impossible for me to vote in this particular civic election.
Interesting.
Like perhaps to the point that there's no good choices, or perhaps to the point that like just based on that, I'm actually going to withdraw myself from that. So it feels like you can make a wise choice on a civic level that actually may be more pragmatic than we make it out to be. And yet you could get to a point where you might say, but on a spiritual level, which overrides anything civic, I just don't know how I would enter into this while maintaining my spiritual integrity, which is more important than anything. So I'm just hypothesizing on that.
So to add a vote to that mentality, if prayer works and the political invitation of the scriptures is to pray for your leaders, regardless of who they are.
Yeah. Yes.
And he's talking about one of the most heinous governments in history, the Roman Empire, when he says this, then maybe the best thing you could do is just pray for the final outcome.
Yeah.
That God would use it, regardless of who ends up in the office. And if we don't think that that's sufficient, then we don't believe what God says about prayer.
And I think you also have to, in that moment, when you say, I'm going to pray for God's outcome, recognize that it can be God's outcome according to scripture without necessarily being reflected in your felt quality of life.
Yeah, like the policies could go all the way you're hoping they don't.
Yeah. So yet
he's actually strong enough to figure that out.
Yeah. So when it says in the Old Testament that Cyrus was God's chosen vessel.
Oh gosh. Yeah.
Cyrus did not look good for the Jewish people.
Not at all.
Like he was an oppressor, like who actually in the end sent them all home, which was a surprising turn of events. But in the meantime, like he was still a conquering ruler. So I actually feel lucky at times to not be able to vote.
I
could see the weight of it.
To make a decision this year.
Yeah.
I'm not excited. I've put more effort in this year than any year prior, and I have less clarity than ever.
Yeah.
So we have 4 minutes to answer this question, so we're probably going to go over. The passage from Galatians, it seems like Paul was calling out Peter for being Christ-like in the beginning. In other words, he was eating with the Gentiles at the beginning. And so it reminds me of the old adage, do the right thing even when no one is looking.
Yeah.
Although I always felt it should have been do the right thing even when others are looking. Christianity at times places a huge importance on social conformity. Maybe even to the point of not being Christ-like, to appear more righteous. At times it is easy to behave as though Pharisees and just follow the rules. Am I interpreting this passage right? And if so, bringing it into the 21st century, how do we be in the world to show Christ-like love for everyone? Who are the Gentiles that we should openly break bread with?
So I think, the first part of the question feels like a little bit more of just a semantic wrestling or even just a circumstantial wrestling. Like I think there'll be times where it's really easy to be Christ-like in front of some people and actually beneficial.
Yeah.
And there's times where it feels unbeneficial or feels like it might.
Like if you're around if you're hanging out with Mother Teresa and you want to be like that.
Uh-huh.
Great.
Yeah,
cool.
Totally. Yeah. And there's that, like that whole tendency that, you might wrestle with. I've just been reading Dark Night of the Soul by St. John of the Cross. It goes after you brutally in terms of the motivations behind certain things.
Brave man.
Yeah. It's like torture. Because you see so much of yourself reflecting. It's a beautiful mirror that you're just like, ouch. So I think depending on the circumstance, you'll either find it easier to do the thing that you know you should do, even though you don't want to, or depending on circumstances, easier to do the thing you want to do instead of the thing you should do because of the people around you as well. So to me, Paul is talking about how the church finds unity and welcome for all people who are following in the way of Jesus, regardless of background. There is no power dynamic for him that should be in place. It's simply all are welcome at the table. So I think for me, like my practice for that is usually deciding like, how can I look out for people that feel like they're outsiders or on the margins and welcome them in? So I try not to spend my Sundays, for example, our primary gathering point, just going around and talking to people that I think are important or rich or stakeholders in the community. I love to talk to those people as well, but watching out for people that are stepping through the doors for the first time. Actually watching out for kids. Like, I think that's one of the beautiful things you can do. Like, notice the children around you.
Yeah.
Because I think when you're pastoring a church, it's really easy to stop noticing those ones. And so just recognizing that Jesus has this beautiful way of noticing those that are on the margins. And even to the extent that you might say he takes the center to the margins.
Yeah.
So I think notice people is maybe even just the most simple thing. Invite people in, show hospitality. Laura and I said not long ago, you know, since Leo was born, hospitality has been something that we just feel like we've done less and less. It felt like we were in a cycle of having people over regularly. And then we had this fourth child and it just feels like now it's just like,
yeah. Us too.
So I think like practicing hospitality is a key element to that.
In the second part of the question, the idea that, we as Christians sometimes get this picture of a good Christian looks like this, 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 and this on the surface. So I'm going to do my best to fit that, fit that image while forgetting my actual deep inner character that makes me be a good human.
Yeah. Yes.
Which this text, I think does reflect to some extent, you know, a little bit, maybe that
it
idea
does a
that
little
like,
bit.
In the final section of that question, if so, bring it into the 21st century. How do we be in the world to show Christ's love to everyone? Mm. Who are the Gentiles that we should be openly? And you said the kids.
Kids are a good example. New people is a good example. Like people from different ethnic backgrounds is a good example. People that look like they are struggling to find a space. I think those are all practical ways you might do that. I think he touched on some, or she touched on some questions there that probably require a deeper answer. I think there's a tension that we feel between acting like we don't feel like acting and almost feeling that might be hypocritical. Like I think C.S. Lewis, it was that talked about that as true hypocrisy. Like be the person you know you should be, being the person you know you should be but aren't. Is different than pretending to be someone that you're not and don't really want to be. And we can't treat the two the same. Does that make sense? When you feel like, you know, super like wired to fall to certain temptations and when you're weird, like, and trying to act like you don't feel like acting, like that's actually a healthy thing. The hypocrisy of the Pharisees is to cover up the things that they're really doing with a false facade. So trying to act like the way in the way of Jesus, even when everything inside you feels like a mess and you're pulled off in all directions is not necessarily the worst thing, but you still are called to focus on developing an inner life that more reflects the way of Jesus.
Yeah.
But there's things that I feel like doing every time I walk out on the street or every time that I'm, you know, have an opportunity to do something that isn't the way of Jesus and not doing them because I know they're the right thing to do, even though I don't feel like it all the time, is not a bad thing necessarily. And we tend to get a little confused on our terms.
Fascinating. Well, we're a little over, so we'll cut it off there. But I have a couple more weeks in this series. I feel like we could have, as we've been talking, we could have gone on for another like 10 weeks. It feels like there's enough subject. But it's heavy.
It is heavy. It is now, a heavy thing to carry.
And one of the things I've noticed is I've been choosing some of these special songs that articulate some of the emotions of doubt during the series. There are so many songs because I feel like doubt and this anxiety around faith and all this stuff is a common occurrence for followers of Jesus.
Yeah.
And it has been for a long time and artists talk about it and we feel it and all these different things. So hopefully it's been helpful for all of you.
Yeah.
And we got a couple more weeks of this and then,
Then it's Pentecost.
Then we get to
baptize, we get to hang out, we get to eat like good food together.
Yeah, so we're going to eat some food. We're going to celebrate. Maybe get some ice cream. I don't know. We'll see how that works out.
Yeah.
If we can pull it together. Yeah. So.
I love it. Well, good to see you all.
Thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you next time. Oh, I pushed the wrong button.